Panel one over and continuation of the visit with Leslie this Saturday at supper, or after supper, the 23rd of December, 72. Channel one over and a continuation of the visit with Leslie after supper this Saturday, the 23rd of December, 72. Channel one over, a continuation of the visit with Leslie this Saturday after supper, the 23rd of December, 72.
Their voices didn't even pause, you know. They didn't. I think they must have been stone deaf, except that they were talking to each other. And they just went right on with whatever they were saying. Their voices never even flagged, you know. And I couldn't get in out of the sun, and I had nothing to do but walk all the way back down, waiting about 10 minutes.
Well, for one thing, now. For one thing, you've got your method of doing it, well, if you see anything much, you don't see it accidentally.
Mm-hmm. Mm, right.
And, you know, just to take sort of loose examples, I don't go to cocktail parties anymore because they're no use to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. I've got no chance. I can't. there's absolutely no way I can. I can't hardly speak to anybody. You know, I'm just lucky if I get to speak to a few people. Well, now you just extend that on until you. What you do, you choose your own ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then. You see, you've got to make something happen.
Mm-hmm.
Until now, that's what that's in Faulkner. That's one of the beautiful things. That's in Faulkner's book, Sword of Hamlet. That's the one he got the Nobel Prize for. And what he's got in there, Ratliff is a narrator. Except he don't bother too much with that. He lets him narrate a little bit, and then he lets him rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives you a picture of Ratliff listening.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find him at the crossroads where the swords are. You'll find him squatting down where the washpots are boiling. You'll find him on the verandas at noon with his feet up where the bacon's from. Now you got three centers of talk. You think that's innocuous, but it's not, you see. He puts it in right. Well, you've got to do that yourself. You've got to get it. Well, you see, I've been doing this for 7 years now, and
you
I never.
You got somebody who goes along with him.
And I never dreamed. You see, that there was. They used to say, "Well, if you want to learn to be objective and impartial and observant, well, now those things don't work for me. I guess I was never observant, but." Just being observant didn't pull in any fish, not for me. Until I got sort of the hang of this, and however I got into it, I don't know. It just, I never intended it. I didn't know to. But little by little, I seemed to see. And, well now, there's a lot of ways you can test it. Miss Rollins at Cross Creek, and at Cross Creek, because it isn't her fiction, she writes, I've never seen anyone say this, but she writes only about the drifters.
Mm-hmm.
Now they listen, they're right next to her, and they were fairly substantial. She mentions Tom. She never mentions Miss Lesson. Mm-hmm. He sat right by me, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you see, you can't even see what she does after she does it.
Exposed
to much American literature,
were
you? No. Well, that wouldn't.
Unfortunately. I've read a lot of her things. Miss Rollins' thing. 3 or 4 of her books. But I've read almost no Faulkner, Mark Twain, very little. It's a weakness in my reading. I've read a few modern things, like The Great Gatsby. I should do some more reading of that type.
Well, you got some eyes already.
Well, it's hard to select what you're reading. This summer I read Kazantzakis' Zorba the Greek in Greek, and that was I enjoyed that very much. I would read a chapter each night before going to bed. It was pretty long, so it kept me busy for most of the summer. I don't know, there's a little bit. Zorba is an interesting character, you know, from the point of view of rejection of standard civilization and usual norms and straitjacket existence. So it's quite interesting. Have you ever read that?
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably like him, actually. But it would be, the kinds of things he talks about are very often the kinds of things that you would be interested in and that you would be familiar with from Faulkner and other writers of that type. It's just the culture would be different. It would be a Greek culture instead of a Southern American one. So, but I think you'd like it if you read it. But it's not really a novel. He calls it Remembrances, the History of the Life of Alexis Zorba, or something like that. And that's actually only about this one little incident in Zorba's life when he was living as head of this mine operation for this young man who had the capital to open this mine. And they had this hut down on the seacoast in Crete. But Zorba sort of hogs the stage for the whole book and spends a lot of time talking about the past to this young man, and it's quite interesting. But there's no other... I've read some other modern Greek prose, and it doesn't have the same... Kazantzakis seems to be unique in his... I mean, he's just much better than any of the others that I've read. Everything else is just novels, and it's not very interesting or very moving. Sentimental and sad, and everyone dies. It's kind of depressing.
I think of a vast amount of things that I have always wanted to get into, and I never have.
I know what you mean. Well, I go through periods. I decide I'm going to read this, and I went through a Tolstoy period, and I didn't do too badly. I read 2 really long novels of Tolstoy within a 2-year period. And I read Don Quixote at one point, and I had my Thomas Mann period, which I'm still in. I'm reading a book of his now. But I tend to read books in foreign languages, because I like to keep my languages going, and so that makes me very fond of Thomas Mann, for example, because I can get the book in German and read it in German and really enjoy the book from start to finish, and I have the added benefit of having read German, so that it keeps my German from getting too stale, because I have to use it all the time, and if I don't keep using it constantly, then then I'll hit some article and I won't be able to figure it out because I haven't read any German in so long. It really goes fast, you know, all of those things. It comes back fast, too, but...
Yeah.
But I think I would like to read maybe Moby Dick next, if I read an American thing. I haven't.
It'll never be the same.
I have the book, but I haven't gotten it. If I ever finish this Thomas Mann thing, I'll be able to do it.
Well, I have got so I don't have a real professional scholar's approach. It's just a sort of an Emersonian scholar.
Well, I don't read these things to pick them apart. I really do read them for fun, but I just sort of, you know, select what I'm going to read next.
Well, I read them to use them.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't read it unless I used it.
Yeah.
Now,
maybe I go to too many cocktail parties. I was just thinking the last time I went to one, what a miserable time I'd had at the one before. And it seems to me that I can't make conversation with people at the cocktail parties, and I have thought about this. Is this some sinister inner lack in me that means I'm a failure? Why is it that I can't talk to these people and their wives?
We lived through the cocktail regime. We went to circuit, you see, for years and years and years.
The bridge regime.
Cocktail, bridge.
Dunn
and Bridge was, you know, this is it. 40 years.
Well,
I'll
tell
you.
Listen, they have these old case books.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing they do, you see, the bibliography of all these writers now is so great. You go blind.
Reading about Faulkner.
The case book will generally pick out. Well, you say they put in 15 or 20 little articles. Well, maybe four or five of them you can use.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the others would be good, but you can't quite use them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's one thing that it kind of shows how it goes. One of the finest articles on this in this little case book on Henry James Turner's school is on the he calls it the term to his point is really evil. This feeling for evil that Henry James works it in, and he works it in so many ways. Now they're all interesting. I can't tell you. I kind of there's no use going into details. But now here's the thing. It's there, and the article comes off is first rate.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have to let it go because I don't think in terms of evil,
mm-hmm.
and nobody else does now.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to somehow know that James did.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't use it. So you just drop it. Now what you want to do, you see, now this is the way it goes.
I bet you need some coffee.
This is the way it goes. It's the governess is 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you have to read the little preface. It does two things. It vouches for her, and then it condemns her. It shows all the obstruction she had. She was a poor minister's daughter, and he was screwball, and she couldn't read novels or anything else. It was her first job. She had no experience. And then she fell in, she was infatuated, Now, James puts everything on her that would keep her from succeeding. Mm-hmm. And he won't let her succeed because it's going to be Freudian. And Freudian, as he says it, he states it in the first sentence, which nobody ever sees. I remember that first summer as a succession of flights and drops. That's Freud. But now you see, that is to say she was nervous. Now, nobody thinks of Freud now unless they think of something sexual or repressions or something that's far along, like the schizoid thing. But you see, you're not interested in that part of Freud. Once you get that far, you have to turn that over to the doctors. Mm-hmm. What you're interested in is the ordinary part of Freud, and that's in there. Mm-hmm. And it's simply a mild form of anxiety, just too much on it makes her nervous. That's Freudian. So that she's not Emersonian any longer because her perceptions are wrong. Like Emerson said, this beloved friend of his family, he says, yes, but how do you know that those perceptions of yours are not from below instead of from above? Well, you see, the little pressure on the governess put her impressions, put her from below. Mm-hmm. So she had her perceptions weren't trustworthy. Now that's Freudian. Now that's a view of Freud that enables you to use him. Mm-hmm. And the other you can't.
It's the bottom of the bottle.
And as I see these youngsters up here read James, it would pay them just to read the daily paper. Because everything they get from it is wrong. And furthermore, it'll lodge in their minds and it'll be a burden to them.
So they shouldn't read it at all.
Well, I'm just overstating it. And I don't know what they do read right. It's so much easier to get just a misread than it is to read. Well, you see, they won't even face the fact that they misread. But you see, I've had to face that for a long time. I remember I used to read Conrad, and I knew something was wrong because I read him. When I read him, he sounded like Kipling. And I just knew that wasn't right. But you see, I didn't have time. If I had had time to take off and read him, I still might not have got very far. And I remember one of the fellows in the next office, he was writing on Conrad, and I went in there every now and then when I got up from there, and I said, I appreciate it. You passed on a little article or something to me sometime. Oh, he says, there's several fine good books on Conrad. So he just rattled them off, and I couldn't even get the names. So that's where I got, you see. Well, one time, I ran into this is a book that he had mentioned to me. Gerard has this book on Conrad, and I only read one chapter, and that's all I needed. And I didn't actually need the whole chapter. I just needed a little hole, and I could go from there. That's a curious thing. And I did it on that river thing of his, that, what do you call it, the Congo? Well, anyhow, it's one of those things, and way up at the end of the trail there was that,
Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness was that crater you see up there with all the tusk ivory. Named Kurtz. And after that, you see, I felt pretty easy with it, but there was a lot I didn't know, but at least I knew enough to get along.
In the world of skulls, it's just, you can't know everything about anything. But you certainly can't know much about anything. And it does look like it could pass on enough to help.
Guy
spent his life with books. It's not just, you know.
Well, they're not much interested in providing material that can be easily used. A really good scholar now is not going to write, let us say, a decent history of Latin literature, which you can read in 250 pages, that will really give you the kind of help that you need. Rather, this scholar is going to write tiny little articles on one or two line passages and perhaps one or two writers of Latin literature. We don't seem to be... no one has the courage to provide large synthesizing works anymore. People are too professional, they're too narrow in their interests. They're all working on inscriptions, or they're working on some peculiar little textual problems in a certain author, or they're working on manuscripts or something like that. Just can't seem to find anyone who is really interested in providing stimulating and yet useful material for others to use. I'm as guilty as the others. But, you know, in the 19th century they ground out these great works for good or for ill, but you still have to use them all the time because there's nothing that has taken their place. You have to go look up somebody's history of Greek literature that came out in 1890. Because nobody has had the courage. Well, Greek literature is an exception because there has been one in the past 20 years. But so few people have had the courage to really try to turn out any kind of a synthesizing work. I think our technology is too refined now. The possibility of error is so great, and that possibility is now so well known.
Yeah.
Since one's very scholarly life hangs from the thread of truth, and or at least what appears to be truth, if they ever find out you're wrong, then you're really in bad trouble. Your students will turn away, and you can't get publication. It's really bad, huh? People are just much more cautious. And that's a negative way of looking at it. A positive way of looking at it would be, such as most of my colleagues would be ready to dispense, I'm sure, the things are getting better and better.
Yeah.
You know, our knowledge, for example, we now know that matter can be destroyed. Whereas 100 years ago, we didn't know this. They take the parallel from the sciences, the natural and biological sciences, or the physical and biological sciences. You know, the whole university setup in this country is basically based on that. The concept of research and everything is all based on the chemistry lab, as far as I can see. You have students who are working with the big shot professor who is doing very little teaching. And there are immediate results in the form of these published studies, and also these PhD dissertations. And if the published studies are good enough, then the big shot professor will get the Nobel Prize or some other grants from the government and so forth. And your research is intimately connected with your teaching because you're teaching the graduate students. And when you start talking about the classics, it's really heresy not to keep up this fiction. My research hardly ever enters into my teaching. I mean, I can occasionally get on the side in, but my research is pretty rarefied. It deals with changes in the language, specifically pronunciation, insofar as we can see it from certain spelling errors in Attic inscriptions over about an 800-year period. And this is very interesting, very important to a small number of people, but not something really that very often can be worked into an elementary course in Homer or still less into a course given in translation, or most of the courses which I teach, even my graduate courses, are rarely on something specifically closely connected with my own research. And the reason for that is that it is such a small area. So I don't have teams of graduate students working on this problem. If I did, there'd be nothing left for me to do. I have to have 10 names on the first page of my book, and I'm not interested in that. But, you know, you start talking about this sort of thing to deans, and their faces just turn white as sheets. To them, research and teaching are inextricably connected, because if they ever find out in Sacramento that they aren't, then they'll say, well, let's get rid of research, and we'll all be teaching 100 courses all the time, and we'll become hacks of one kind or another, because we won't be able to do anything except grind out notes that we've been preparing at the last minute. Of course, research is important, but because in my research I can make some significant contribution, something new, you see, which is not being done by anybody else, but if I spent all of my time preparing material for elementary teaching, I think I'd be a much less knowledgeable and a much less interesting teacher in the long run. But you can't sell them in Sacramento on that. I mean, you have to sell them in this other way. And I think that the parallel is the whole jargon and everything seems to me to apply only to the sciences. It makes good sense to talk about it in these terms in the sciences, but it breaks down very much in the humanities, I think.
I
don't know what got me off.
You know, the first thing I did when I don't know where I got the idea of a grant. I never thought about a grant before. But I went down to the College of Agriculture, Dean York, or Provost York, or Vice President York, and I told him that of where I worked, that we just got little fellowships that helped us along a little bit, and we never even applied for grants that was more than $1,000. And that I needed something larger than that. And all his grants were large because he had to do so much in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe he could refer me to somebody on his staff that would give me one or two little pointers. And what happened was, he sent me. They call her Lady York or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Mrs. Jobes. They call her. She's been with him for years. So I talked to her. And I tried to tell her what I was doing, and I just sat there and sort of swallowed my tongue. It's an awful experience. So I told her I'd just go think it over and see if I figure out what I was doing. So I wrote out a little something and gave it to her.
Yeah, that's
it. I did too. And you guess who she referred me to? Debbie's next door neighbor down there, Sean Gregory. And he introduced himself to me when I got over there as the only full-time sociologist in the College of Agriculture. The only agricultural sociologist. Well, he kept telling me so many things that I'm afraid I wasn't going to get any word. And pretty soon he told me that didn't mind telling me that he was completely deaf in one ear. And he just had to fall asleep here. And the other. Mr. Jobs and Dr. York Sexton sent me to him. Because I didn't get anywhere at all. And I still don't know how to go about getting a little larger grant.
Maybe they didn't want you to know. They thought you might get some of theirs. It's a closely guarded secret.
Well, you hear all these things about this money around. They will say for new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Innovative.
Well, at Berkeley, for example, there's a lot of money for innovation and teaching. If you can come up with new plans for undergraduate teaching, innovation in this area, they'll give you the money. But you have to have a very specific project, very well written out, and, you know, it's like using tape recorders instead of something else, probably. And the money is just doesn't amount to a hill of beans. I mean, maybe they'll give you $3,000. So you can spend a whole year working on something that might not ever ever get off the ground. I don't know whether they've had very many takers or not. I don't think they have. I mean, if they give you job security and 2 years off and $50,000, well, I think I could come up with some very good plans. I don't think they'd like them because they would involve hiring a lot more faculty, which, of course, is the last thing they want to do.
I don't know what those grants used to amount to. I think one thing they used to amount to is that they helped you get a raise or a promotion. The universities, they would give you, let you have a year off on half pay,
mm-hmm.
and then this grant would take up the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mere fact that you got a grant was sort of recognition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that would be a form of recognition. I never thought of it that way. They always ask you to list all grants.
That was true up until World War II, and then the thing came so fast, especially through the sciences, you know,
mm-hmm.
that all their old system was just mm-hmm. gone, and nobody even thinks about it anymore.
Well, lastly, after your first year at Oberlin, you've been on some sort of grant.
Just about. Uh-huh. Of course, the grant, since I got my degree and started teaching, was just supplementary for the summer and to
mm-hmm.
enable me to go
yeah.
to Greece. And my salary has been my source of income.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I could have made it to Greece a number of summers without a grant, but it certainly helped
mm-hmm.
to have the grant.
But
they've averaged about $1,000 a summer,
mm-hmm.
which isn't very much by the time you add in the
mm-hmm.
airfare.
But even in Oberlin, you got student grants,
mm-hmm.
and of course at Harvard.
Harvard, I was entirely financed
yeah.
right from the start. Whenever I ran short of money, they usually came through with some more. I think my parents gave me some money my first year at Harvard, mostly out of inertia. They just kept sending it to me, and I put it in the bank and used it that summer when I went to Europe for the first time. But after that, they didn't send me anything, and I was entirely financed by grants. And at Oberlin, I had quite a bit of support, too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just one-man grant.
Right. That was not the type of thing you're talking about, which
yeah.
is different.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Your sources would really be more like foundations,
mm-hmm.
I would
say. What I found and what we picked up was right now they seem to prefer to organizations and individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And several fellows in this Historic Gainesville Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done, they did that for that reason. They
mm-hmm.
incorporated for that reason.
I had a friend who got a lot of money from the National Endowment for the Humanities. $7,000 he got for a project even more rarefied and more epigraphical than mine. And the way he did it was really clever. He had Mr. Dow advising him on it and how to go about filling out the forms. he got another guy whose PhD dissertation wasn't worth publishing, another one of Mr. Dow's students, who had no project, and they got together as collaborators on this worthless project. He got two graduate students into the picture, which he calls his graduate assistants, and they go in as a corporation, as a team, and that just bowled the National Humanities people off their feet. I mean, they just thought it was wonderful, you know, team aspect. This is very attractive to them, apparently. So they gave him all this money, and really it's just Steve Tracy's old project that he hasn't been able to get published because it's so, nobody would read it. I mean, it's so rarefied and so abstruse and very narrow. I really doubt myself if it's worth publishing. I think probably maybe typescript copies filed in 4 or 5 depository libraries would be enough. He works on inscriptions that are carved by a single mason. He can tell this by the guy has a particular way of carving his letter A, his alpha. And so he was an Attic mason, but of course Athenians set up inscriptions on Delos and up at Delphi. And so he can go up to Delphi and he can just go along the inscriptions and he finds those alphas. And so he immediately knows that that text was carved by the same man. So the project, which he's gotten the money for, is to examine every single Attic public inscription of the period 210 to 150 BC to see if they can isolate the hands, that is to say, catalog them by hand, by handwriting, so they can find out how many masons were at work, how many stone carvers were at work on public inscriptions during that period. Was it 7? Was it 37? Was it 100? Really, this is not worth $7,000 of the taxpayers' dollars. The immediate question that comes to my mind after hearing the project, even as a classicist, is yes, but who cares how many masons there were working? I mean, it's just so...
You know, this is one thing that I came up with. You see, last year when I was canvassing in the place, and I had to face the fact, see, that Shakespeare and Chaucer and Milton had a considerably larger appeal than I did with my countryside. But I said to him, I said, yes, but somebody ought to deal with living human beings. And you know what it did? It made them flinch. They wouldn't say, yeah, I think you're right, let's deal with a few. Don't anybody ever take anybody up anymore? I'm not going to stop the Shakespeare scholarship.
It's not exactly very close.
And you see, you ought to try it sometimes.
Well, Guy has been helped. Now, you see, the university has helped him to keep this thing alive. And, you know, he's had small...
Oh, yeah, you couldn't do it yourself.
He's, you know, they've given grants and things. But this project is just... Because the way we see it, it ought to be done. It's valuable, and others think so too.
Well, all of it, you see, is against all the tendencies now.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's entirely true.
It's still worthwhile. Well, you see, experience is abandoned now.
Well, by the scholarly establishment it is, but if you go to private foundations, I think the private foundations are rather fed up with the scholarly establishment to a large extent, and this is reflected in things like the Ford Foundation, for example, which made the decision, first of all, to quit underwriting the Woodrow Wilson people, so it cut them off about 5 years ago, and secondly, what it did then was pump all of its money into 10 of the best graduate schools. Harvard and Berkeley were among them, of course, and Cornell, too. Then they cut that away. And they say they're putting all their money into projects to help the blacks and get them out of the tenements and innovative projects and things like that, more socially oriented projects. We're tired of turning out PhDs that just go write articles on Shakespeare and get accused by their students of being irrelevant. So other private foundations may feel the same way.
Leslie has contacts everywhere, and I don't have them anywhere except in Leslie County. I wish he could put in a week or two, just a week or two down here sometime, and just actually see, you know, just sort of get a feel for this, because it's valid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, next summer when you come, just plan that.
Well,
next.
I don't know whether you'll ever have time or not, but
in between your paintings.
It would be nice, you
it
see, because
we could
I don't know. Way. You see, I don't know what the others do. I've lost touch with it. You see, I had those two detached retinas, and it cut me down on reading, and also I
mm-hmm.
can't get out at night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say I'm sitting here with a light. But this light, I fix these lights so they don't hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go to a public place there where they've got all that, what do they call it, saturation.
That's the reason we don't go.
30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Is
mm-hmm.
about, so that cuts me down. And I don't have any, I didn't write the book, you see. All I've done is just get certain little glimpses.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I know one thing, it gets these young people going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really does. And it does for the reason I told you a while ago, you see. Now, it took me all this time. And it was a certain, my element of clashing in it. Well, I didn't clash with anybody. I just clashed with my friends. But, say, they are right proud now for the creative writing program at the university.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm proud of it, too. I mean, I've got nothing against it. But what I was trying to say to them is what I told you.
Mm-hmm.
There's the minor form.
Mm-hmm.
That'll liberate so many that will never get up to the major form.
Right.
Well,
instead
of starting with the major form, with the major form, they can.
Now, what I have found, let me tell you, I can show you. I've worked with this stuff so much, and what I find is that so much of the major stuff. Nobody can actually get a good square idea of what's in it,
mm-hmm.
and it's doubtful whether the writer knew or not.
Yeah.
Now, I can show you that. I can show it to you. I mean, it's not hypothetical. And one of the I can give you several cases that just as. Circumstances you hope, wish for.
Hmm.
Now that's your major form. You read a short story and you think, well, this is nice. I see his point of view. But you don't see it. It's not there. There's no certainty at all in the reading of it. I don't mean everybody's got to agree, and I don't want to get into dialectic about it. But I mean it just ain't clear. I mean, you're always uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've taught Keats's odes, you see, time and time again. I'll tell you right straight. I've not got the faintest idea of what he's writing about. And that's in my own language. It's actually not in my language, because English is not my language,
mm-hmm.
and I understand very little of it. I used to try to, when I was way over there, I used to try to listen to some of the English. I didn't have any idea what they were saying to me. It was just straight table talk, you see. So I quit that. Well, now I'm not.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just being straightforward about it. A great deal of the stuff, the pattern on top is not there. I remember old Ronald Crane, who was a visiting professor here from the University of Chicago, I guess it was, when I first came to Florida. And we were pretty thick with Archie then, and I used to be out there, and we had a big time. He was nice. And I'd give him those bird books, take him over to Lake Alice. And he was writing on Gulliver, and I said to him, whenever you write that, I want to be sure and read it, because I'm never quite certain what Gulliver said. He says, well, I've been working on it for 30 years, and I'm not certain what Gulliver said. And what it's the truth. Nobody knows what Swift meant.
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to be any way of finding out. And you still, you got him hung up there in the anthologies.
Well, that's certainly true of a lot of the ancient Greek writers, too. There's even less chance of finding out what they meant. Those plays of Sophocles, for example, where everything is so ambiguous, and you just can't really know. Article after article comes out interpreting them, but you're always left with the feeling that it's not certain. Maybe that's what
I think about these chaps, these young people that work with me, and I did well. I can rot them around Swift. One thing and another, pretty soon you're rotting them around a great deal. And you wonder where you're going to rot them to. And you know, I've thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you see, I would like for them to know that the writers that I know, the ones I mentioned, Emerson and on, well, the way they present them now gives me goosebumps. You see, Emerson has been sort of in my blood since my graduate school days, at least since World War II. And, I mean, he just sort of a driving force, those things he did in the 30s. And now, they teach him, or present him, as hung up. He got scotched himself. And one of the chief pieces they use to show it is his essay on Montaigne, The Skeptic. I read Montaigne, The Skeptic, and to me it's a hilarious thing. He's not hung up to me, but he is to this scholar who's good. He's one of the finest. He wrote this little bitty book on him, and it stands up. If you want to go through Emerson and find out everywhere he's hung up, you can do it. Well, but you see, Poe wrote around 30 short stories and about a half a dozen of them worth reading. So, what do you want to find where he hangs up? Find where he don't hang up. Now, I've always worked with Wordsworth. I've read a good bit of Wordsworth, first and last. But the only thing that ever stuck with me is Rollins. Is that his name? He has his two volumes on Wordsworth's Prelude. On the one he didn't publish in his lifetime. He kept it out of print. He wrote in 1805, and he wasn't published till he died in 1850.
Mm-hmm.
And Wordsworth was known by the excursion, and that's pompous, and by our standards, and Mm. It's very hard to read now. But you can read his prelude in that 1885 edition. And that's all I know. That's all I know of Wordsworth. All the rest of them you can have. But you see, his contemporaries didn't know it.
Well, the only thing that Thoreau used in Emerson was one, wasn't the nature essence. He didn't bother with the other. I always think when Guy talks like that about all these people who, well, you know, that awful book that was written on Winston Churchill by his doctor on his bowels. You know why?
To make money, yeah. But.
I know, but it's so.
There's a whole genre of books by physicians of notables. I once read one by the Kaiser's dentist, and it had a chapter on the Kaiser, and it had a chapter on the Crown Prince, and it had a chapter on the Kaiserin, and the whole family. There's a chapter on the minister, too, at the end. And it was just anecdotes about their visits to his office and what they said and did. They all tended to be rather gossipy in the dentist's chair. It appealed to a very common trait of the reading public, which wants to know this kind of minor detail about people like that. That's why we have movie magazines, and on the television, why they chase Mrs. Kennedy around. Those people, so you can see how they live privately.
You know, I think of many fantastic things. You know, Whitman's 1855 Leaves of Grass. The great poem, as they call it, is not the Leaves of Grass that he finally published, but the first one. Mm-hmm. Now, he sent it around, and Emerson wrote him that letter, and he says, "I greet you on the beginning of a remarkable career. Some things in here are said immeasurably well." And then he got it out again the next year. He did his printing himself. He set it up, and he put Emerson's letter in it. Well, that wasn't quite cricket, but it was circulated. And you wonder why Emerson made so much difference to him. Well, now, here's where the scholars help you. You see, you can't get along without the scholars, even though they do what I said. They show Emerson is hung up. They still got a vast amount of information which I don't have. So you see, I'm dependent on them. The one part of Emerson that floated Whitman was that one lecture, The Poet. Mm-hmm. That was the only thing at the middle of the 19th century left that had that old bardic influence.
Mm-hmm.
You see where you had the divine afflatus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Whitman got it and put it into the leaves, that the Leaves of Grass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last thing in American literature that has it. And I was trying to etch out a few chapters on these things I've been doing. And I got to thinking, you see, what he does is write about an illumination. Things that are ineffable. Well, these things I write rather difficult to set down too. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if I had some little bardic Medium I could use. You see, that's really beats bushes. But see, I don't have any. I got to write plain, straight English.
I think the thing to do is to get your project up to the forum stage and just let Leslie fill it out without knowing any more about it than he knows now.
Yes, he knows.
That's enough. That's all you need. He knows the jargon.
Well, I'll tell you.
And just anything he puts down would be something that would pass.
Well, I'll tell you. Rick could do it with him.
Sure he could.
If I did it, I'd get him all confused.
That's right.
You coming back through?
You mean in January? I don't think so.
This is your only appearance?
Come on, Lester, come back through and get Guy $40,000 grant.
I don't think there's enough hope that I would. No, I'm going to Philadelphia to a convention on the 27th, and I don't think I'll be coming back down this far.
Yeah.
I don't think there'll be enough time
before
school starts. The convention lasts till the 31st.
Well, Rick could just send it to him.
He could just send it to me.
Just send it to him.
Or I could maybe pick out something on the typewriter and see what happens.
Then once you get together, and Leslie could see whether it would be, he could be your consultant. Get paid for that.
Oh, yes, put me down for something in the grant. Secretarial service or something, $5,000. Well, that's $4,000.
You worked right hard for that.
That's right.
Put in an evening.
Well, I tell you, this man may not have got any foundation grants, but he's the most granted man I know.
When are you leaving? Well, that's an awful time to leave the 27th.
Well, I pretty well have to. The thing in Philadelphia starts on the 28th, but I'll still be a day late getting there. I'll get there on the 29th.
Oh, you mean you're going to try?
Yeah. So then I can deduct the expenses for the trip, you see, as a business trip. So I shouldn't have to pay any income tax in April. I have my fingers crossed, but...
Well, you've got to get that thing... Yeah, well...
Well, let's see. Rick can run up here. There's not enough leeway in there.
Mm-mm.
Well, tomorrow's Christmas Eve, and everybody's going to be rushing around, and then Christmas...
And then
my brother is coming up with his wife, or if he can't get off, he's a veterinarian. If he can't get off, we're going to go down to Kissimmee and have Christmas down there. But we will have a family get-together on Christmas. And the day after Christmas, Mother is off, so we might go over to Daytona Beach to visit my aunt, my great-aunt. She's pretty close to 90, and we haven't been to see her in a long time.
Well, I'll tell you what, we could just get it signed in blood right here that Leslie will answer.
Oh, sure. If you send me something, I'll try to do something with it.
He'll put something down. Send the what you and Rick work out and then the blanks and let him put something down.
Well, he could talk to you.
I could call him up if there's something confusing. And we can talk over the phone or something.
You could look it over what he got down on paper and...
I'll probably send back a letter with a couple questions or something. And then you can answer that, or he can answer that, and then I'll try to fill out the form. I don't know. I've gotten a lot of grants, but I've always had the feeling that my getting of the grants has depended very heavily on the people who backed me, who were people like Mr. Dow, who, you know, have been president of this and that and the other, and are in the scholarly establishment.
Sure.
So it's not all knowing the jargon, but I could probably help you get it into some form that would be, would make it look a lot more like something that they'd give money to, and in fact it is. I don't know. We'll have to see. But I don't mind doing that. I mean,
well,
I don't predict any success, particularly in view of a large amount of money.
Well, you see, this is...
Now this, I was working on this, and the other morning, let me see, I got to see it.
I'll tell you one thing, if you get the money, I doubt if you'll get a renewal. So you better spend your $40,000 carefully. Because I know that at the end of the 4 years, they're going to say, well, now, what have you done?
What? He's writing a book, you know.
Oh, I see.
And all this business.
I don't see that one little thing.
That you wrote out this morning, yeah, yesterday.
Well, anyhow, here it is. Now, this is Paul Cunningham on that day program. Frank, a number of museums are changing their style these days. Now, this does the same thing. It goes through the process of stating it very clearly, just as if he was applying for a grant. So now what you're aiming at is to get the style, the new style,
mm-hmm.
So much so that a few of the very good ones have even become victims of their own success.
Wouldn't we all like to do that?
There's more expense. Now what has attracted many visitors to some museums is a new approach. To the people they serve. The museum's no longer being repositories for items of art, history, and science. Now, see, that's one of those negative statements that you always take in that are never true. There is an effort. Now, you see, he's still got the new approach, but he's added new approach to the people they serve. There is an effort to relate more to the people they serve. And that includes especially those who live in our new urban communities, inner city people.
Blacks. In other words,
of differing races and cultural base. Now that's a little euphemism there, isn't it? The ghettos. Now here in New York City, the American Museum of Natural History has come up with several programs illustrating this effort. See, he hadn't quite given a name yet. It's still a new style, a new approach, and here it's this effort. A brand new one is called the People Center. An idea of the museum's chairman of education, Dr. Malcolm Harris. Now you got the People Center. The purpose of the People Center is to help. Now here's the whole thing, and this is the payoff. This is it. The purpose of the people. Now this is really this is really fact. The purpose of the People Center is to help visitors better understand human relationships through cultural experience. But now you see, that won't quite do it, because you've always got to have a label to hang it on, and here it is. Some call it participatory anthropology.
What is that thing? What is this thing?
That's a new approach to the museum. And what they do. Go ahead and read it.
That's just how you be crystal clear.
Yeah, I've been crystal clear.
It's just a screen. That you did this morning?
Yeah. Oh, I had
it. Well, he just tasted. And then it just occurred to him, you know, that it was about the funniest thing he'd ever heard. And it was just exactly what they're asking him to do for this grant, you know. And just how difficult it is to be crystal clear. I don't know, guys.
I'd really like to have a copy of this. You just taped this off the TV, is that it?
Yeah.
Boy, that's funny.
Probably the Xerox or something.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah. He's got one that's better than that.
Okay.
So he just wrote, isn't that it?
Now, here it is. Yeah. I wrote it out. It's not exactly a simple idea. The American Museum of Natural History has come up with several programs illustrating this effort. Now, this new style of museum, one program is called People Center, and this is the first technical term, or really, it is a technical term made popular, and is attributed to the chairman of education museum. And now we have the full technical statement we have been waiting for, to better understand human relationships through cultural experience. And then the label right following it, to hang it on, you see, participatory anthropology. Now, it won't do to visualize such a term. Somehow, anthropology itself comes out as the showcase and participates. There's absolutely no way of visualizing those big terms. And right away, as is expected in any kind of journalism, they won't let stiff statements and terminology stand. They make it simple. Getting people, and that's what he said, more simply, or simply, it just means getting people to understand others. And do so with what is available in excellent museums. Now, this is not too simple. The others may not be simply each other or other people, but other people. Puerto Ricans will understand Haitians. Or the black race, the yellow race. You've got the most beautiful possibility. For two individuals to understand each other is below the anthropological level of a great museum. First cultural experience. It centers around a cloak that is 2,000 years old, worn about the time of that first Christmas. And we are outside the bounds of anthropology, you see, just assuming that there was a first Christmas. Except that an official of the museum explains where the color in the cloak came from. Does it in the childish manner of asking the question before he goes ahead and gives the information. Can anyone tell where this comes from? The the effort, the effect, as Paul Cunningham has it, is that suddenly 2 millennia are telescoped for those present. The picture is of a jointed hand telescope being pushed together. Now the telescope could go the other way. It's going to be a telescope. And we do not know what occurs in the mind contemplating millennia. But it is really more to the point to see how others in another time lived. Or as I would say it, they wore cloaks too. Just make it concrete. Now another museum official takes a hand. He's younger. He has long, graceful fingers. In effect, he starts all over again to explain the new program. And he works a bit hard at it. It is really a business-like approach he has. We are trying to do two things in the People's Center. I didn't realize how much he put into the first thing. We are trying to make people aware of the fact that we, Western culture, American culture, is part of the world. Now you got children out there, little 10-year-olds. So that not just third world people are on the glass, but we are curious and beautiful people too. Just the secretary there is interesting. Children and adults are in this little studio audience. One little boy does the talking for all of them, but he didn't talk now. Then the second thing we are trying to do, and then a summary, and that is what this People Center is all about, he says. I would say this official takes a fresh start. He may say the same thing as the museum's director of education, but he says it differently. And then two more examples of understanding human relationships through cultural experience come up. One is a caribou. That is sought of as a Native American reindeer. They touch one without going to Lapland. I presume it is a stuffed one they touch. And last, the gifts of the Magi. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And I don't know how to spell the rest. Obviously, several expert hands are at work to explain a new style in museums. They don't just go ahead with all that this participatory anthropology. They labor to make the theory of it very clear. Maybe it is to avoid the danger of having children and adults come in just to touch a reindeer in the Christmas season. It is not the reindeer that's important. It's the human relationship at the moment of a cultural experience. I keep thinking there ought to be a simpler way. I remember I wished I could talk to Professor McGregor of Columbia back when he put up there the asset of man, the Java man and the Peking man and all, and I had him as professor at Columbia. I remember I wished I could talk to Professor McGregor of Columbia and ask him just why he put the Java man just where he did. He was a charming talker with a great fancy for chimpanzees. But that would be the old repository kind of museum, I guess. With none of the new relationships. Now, that is...
That's marvelous.
Now, what you need, is it?
Now, that's the same thing I've been keeping me awake at night.
Make it crystal clear. Oh. what you need would be the straight thing on the television and then go.
Oh, yes, it's on the tape.
Yeah. Oh.
See, I have a feeling we just talked Leslie down.
Well, see, you just hogged it because I don't know one thing Leslie's been practicing on. We didn't even mention music.
Well, you don't have a good piano here, though. I would
no.
play for you sometime.
What are you doing now?
Sweet Bergamasque of BBC.
Oh,
you know, the middle one, the third one is Claire de Lune.
Yeah.
But the others are very nice, too.
Uh-huh.
Been working on that. I've been working on the third ballade.
Uh-huh.
I haven't had much luck with that. And a couple pieces by Poulenc.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you can do the biggest. If you'd come on over that rainy afternoon, you could have played for us.
Excellent.
We needed somebody. Most
yeah.
of the students fell apart. I think the weather had something to do
mm-hmm.
with it.
I would have come over if I didn't. I just hated to expose those little kids.
Well, I wouldn't
Christmas.
Want you to expose them.
They would have caught it for sure.
That wouldn't have been right.
The children are so susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you two will get it.
Well, you're older than me.
I hope so.
You look like you had a rest.
What?
You look like you had a rest. That's what happens sometimes when you get sick. You know,
you
rest
you
up
do.
A little bit
you
and
look
do. Better before you got sick.
Right. One of my colleagues always gets real sick. He's a young man, and he always gets real sick for about a week, and he just, when he comes back afterwards, he looks awful, and then he goes out and looks awful. And I was talking to his wife about it, and she said, oh, well, we've been so upset this fall because John hasn't gotten sick. He hasn't had that week of staying in bed and resting up. And I thought, so that's how you deal with the quarter system. You
yeah.
just get sick. So I think about the middle of next quarter, I'm just going to call in and say, I have a terrible bug. And I can't budge out of bed and just spend the whole week in bed reading or something like that. And it might work out all right. Well,
yeah.
you have Rick write up the stuff in some form and send the application. And maybe I can do something with it. Send it back to you.
And put it to bottom. Don't forget my 4%.
Okay.
10%.
10%. Yes, she's already trying to do it. I better watch her.
That's right.
I certainly enjoyed this visit.
Well, it's been fun. We look forward to these.
I sure am sorry I didn't get here during the daylight hours. It's unbelievably green. Of course, it's
uh-huh.
green up where you are. But
I wondered. Yes,
well, it's my fault. I didn't. I said come in the afternoon, but
well,
I didn't say it dark.
I was going to come a little bit earlier. I thought I'd drive out about sunset because it's so nice then, but I just fell asleep.
Well, you probably needed
to.
You even came. Guy, he came in his jeans and
mm-hmm.
his boots. Good walking shoes.
Yeah.
This is the first time he's come out really for the country
right.
in his country clothes.
That's right. These are more hiking stuff. We go about every week or every other week at the most to a place that's only about 40 miles from us, but it's way out in the middle of nowhere. It's called Point Reyes National Seashore. And there are all these trails up there through the mountains, and
mm-hmm.
it's just beautiful country. And in the winter, there are not very many people who go.
Mm-hmm.
We go and hike for about 10 miles once a week. Or once
that's
a week.
Good
yeah.
for you,
Leslie. It really is.
That's very good.
To get out.
Yeah, that's very good. That's why you're looking so good.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
riding a bicycle to school every day has a lot. It helps a lot because it's a long way and it's uphill. So
mm-hmm.
that keeps me busy, too.
Yeah. And your sister, she's a... In pharmacy.
She's in pharmacy at university, and she seems to be doing very well. So,
mm-hmm,
very
so you're going to have a pharmacist in your family
yeah.
again.
Well,
and your mother is all right.
She's fine.
Uh-huh. I never see her.
We have a nice trip to Europe and Greenland and Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I maybe she'll come again.
Well, that would be good. We'll keep Leslie. And he'll come next summer. He'll stay 3-4 weeks.
Well, you got a pain. We'll go out and have a pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
We'll make a deal on that.
There's a lot more than painting. I don't think you want to get into it.
Well, let me tell you, I haven't painted out here in 7 years. I've painted all of it in and out when I first came to Coast. Up at the office there in Anderson, they brought Steve Free back over there. Consolidated. And they've been doing those offices all up. And they've got some that very much fresh paint up there. It is marvelous. I tell you, there's nothing like fresh paint, is there?
Institutions just, they have a rotating thing, and they just paint everything sort of sick green about every 2 years. And
well, this
it's
is
marvelous how efficient they are.
This is that's right now, but this is white. Bright white.
You people really live the life of Raleigh.
Yeah.
Everything
about
it is that sick green. Must be some kind of a natural dye. They just squeeze some plant into it and it turns that color because everything is that color. It must be real cheap.
Yeah.
I believe things are a little better out there this time.
I
right?
think they are. I'm taking things more in my stride.
Mm-hmm.
Let things go.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more
mm-hmm.
than I used to,
mm-hmm.
and I don't pay attention to a lot of charisma that goes on. I never read the papers anymore. I set my office up in my home now, so I do all my work in my own home. And that's much pleasanter. The office at the university is rather small, and I don't know. There's always something going on over there to depress you, no matter what it is. Either the library's closing because it doesn't have enough money, or you're finding out that the department has been shafted this way or that. I mean, it's just very depressing if you get caught up in university life.
Yeah.
But if you just don't pay any attention to it and do your own work and teaching, it can be pleasant.
A little shock.
Every day there's something, you know. They say, well, we've got to increase the teaching load 25%, you know. And I keep thinking, well, if they don't decrease the teaching load, I'm not going to be able to make it through the next year. And, you know, it's just, I used to read the little newspaper every day, and I think that's one of the things that was different. I never looked at that anymore. I get along much better.
Yeah.
I have a roommate now. I took one of my friends in. I made him one of the bedrooms in the house.
Oh, that's it. If it's a
he's just nice.
Mm-hmm.
I love the things that I hated most doing and don't have to do anymore. He often goes to the grocery store and things like that. He seems to like it, actually.
Uh-huh.
Enjoy going and feeling the fruits and vegetables with all the other people who seem
uh-huh.
to enjoy that so much. It's surprising how in a town in which most of the population is either faculty or students at the university, the major pastime on Saturday and Sunday is to go to the food market and feel the fruits and vegetables. That seems to be the point at which they, that's as far as they've got. I mean, really. Bankrupt situation. So I get out of that now.
Well, let me get a little spike here.
How have your horses been doing? Did you still have the same ones?
No, I just have two. We lost Missy.
Oh, what happened?
Well, she never recovered from that pneumonia she had several years ago.
Oh, that's true.
But it was a pretty big shock to me. God, we learned more from. She taught us everything we knew, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put some oranges in here for later.
Well, you're going to give them a sack. If they don't, they can throw them out.
Well,
that sack is easy to carry, man. The big one, the other one. I don't know what sort of sack they are. That's a feed sack.
Yeah, that's what is that? Kind of the material of it.
No, it's where we were going to pick. here and you get to go.
I love to be home.
Now you should have come on and we should have picked.
Y'all just set that this big back in there.
Well, you might want to use it.
Oh, God almighty. I got many back time.
Well, you should recycle this back. You should use it over and over and over. If you don't, it'll be floating in the Pacific Ocean. Nothing could eat it.
That will destroy it. It's in the cupboard. Well, you see, if you'll take it with you, I won't have to recycle it.
That's why I'm leaving it here. All my waking hours. That's why I'm in the bottle place.
Hmm.